Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Ijaz Ahmad was handsome, charismatic, and a self-made businessman. He arrived in the United States from Pakistan determined to fulfill his mother's dying wish, to come to America, complete his education, and make his mark in the world. Settling in Memphis, Tennessee, Ijaz became owner of several businesses, father to a handsome boy, and a devout Muslim. The only thing missing in his life was a wife, someone special to protect, honor, and love. Leah Ward was a pretty girl, but a prison parolee with a history of drug charges, petty crime, and a questionable past. She led a flotsam life, drifting from town to city to state. When she was introduced to Ijaz Ahmad, she believed she had found the ultimate answer, a place to live, someone to take care of her, and money to spend. But what began idyllic soon became abusive and then dangerous for Ijaz. His friends and family warned him, and in May of 2003, Ijaz paid the ultimate price when family members found his mutilated body in a shed. The book that we're featuring this evening is She Is Evil, a story of trust, abuse, religion, and murder, of a kind man who tried to help a troubled woman and became the victim of abuse and eventually a heinous murder. Book that we're featuring this evening is She Is Evil, Madness and Murder in Memphis, with my special guest Judith A. Yates. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Judith A. Yates.
Well, thank you very much for asking me, and I know it means a lot to Ijaz's family that you're telling his story.
It's an incredible story. Let's get right to just briefly why and how you came to want to write this story and how you came into to be in a position to write this story, She Is Evil.
Okay. Well, I have been a domestic violence prevention educator for over 25 years. And the case intrigued me because it was female to male, which is so rare. It is so difficult to find, literally, or sometimes impossible to even investigate and to get numbers on. And then secondly, you know, since 9/11, I have Muslim friends. I have friends from the Middle East. And I believe Muslims and Middle Easterns are being lumped together all as these terrorists and negative people and hating America. And I wanted to show the positive side of these people, the positive side of the Muslim religion. You know, and even the prosecutor told me that they worried about the trial because the country was still reeling from 9/11 attacks. And Ijaz was Muslim and Leah was from America and a white female. And they actually worried about the outcome of the trial or even taking it to trial because of that, which I think is wrong. So I felt like I needed to tell the story.
Yeah, it's incredible that that would be a factor to even consider by the district attorney a couple years after 2001, obviously, but still, as the audience will find out. Let's get to introducing some of the main characters because this is an incredible story and we need as much time as we can to fully explore this. And so let's talk about Ijaz Ahmad, originally from Pakistan. Tell us about his family and how he made his way to America and why.
Okay. Well, Ijaz was born in February 1962, and his family had moved to Talisbad, where he was born. And they had built impressive and numerous businesses to put a roof over their head and to survive. And they had many shops. He had a brother who was a jeweler. He had a sister who was a dressmaker. And his mother and father, you know, helped run the businesses. Well, his father died early, and his mother came to Ijaz one night and said, "You need to go to America and you make dreams your dreams come true." And he said, "Why are you telling me this at this time?" And she told him that she had saved up a little bit of money that she should have been spending on herself so that he could go to America. Now, Ijaz already had a bachelor's degree in engineering, and she was telling him to pursue his education, and she died in his arms from a heart attack that night. So to fulfill his mom's dying wish, he came to the United States. He learned English. Ijaz was kind of a Renaissance man. He knew several languages. He had 2 degrees. He ran several successful businesses, and he was always looking into other avenues, into other businesses, you know, selling cars, owning land. And in the meantime, he would work another full-time job, and he also was completing his other degree. Now, one important thing about Ijaz was he was a devout Muslim. He didn't believe in drugs or alcohol. He worshipped every time at the mosque. He would go to the mosque and worship at mosque there locally in Memphis. And he believed to help your community, because one of the important issues with the Muslim community is to help each other. And also to respect your wife, to respect your family. And that's what Ijaz was about. He was a kind man. He was a nice man. His ex-wife, who was married to him twice, her family, his friends, none of them told me that he had any kind of abusive or even hatred or temper. And his mother-in-law and his wife had come from abusive households. They never saw anything like that in Ijaz. He was just a nice, nice guy, very handsome, intelligent. Now, he could lose his temper, but it was never anything abusive, but absolutely no history of violence.
Let's talk about Ernestine Marsh and her daughter, Bonnie Garrett, and tell us about just how they met, how Ijaz met Bonnie through Ernestine. So tell us about that meeting, and tell us about who Bonnie is and her background before we talk about how they met in their relationship.
Sure, I love this story. It's a true love, falling in love relationship. Ernestine had a friend who was from the Middle East, and one day he brought his friend named Ijaz over to meet Ernestine. And Ernestine's daughter Bonnie was in the room, and she told me the minute she looked at Ijaz, she said, "I'm going to marry that man." And then, you know, practical self kicks in and she thinks, "What are you talking about? You had a relationship. He left you when he found out you were pregnant. He was not a good person. He was mean. Why are you even looking?" And she said, "But I just knew when I looked in his eyes, there was something there." Now, this is years later when she and I are talking, when I'm interviewing her, and you could still see it in her eyes and her body language. She was very much in love right away with Ijaz. And Ijaz kept looking at her, and then he'd look away to talk, and then he'd look at her, and she said it was just even electrical across the room. And they began talking. Ijaz asked her out, and she said, the first date was a movie. And she said, "I can't even remember the name of the movie because they were just so intelligent, emotional, you know, the heart, everything was just wrapped up into each other." And that
now
is
you talk
how
about
Bonnie. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, that's how they met, and that's how they got along, and they did not move in together because it was against his religion. It is against the Muslim faith to move in or cohabitate with a woman that is not your spouse or a blood family relative. But they just, you know, everything about each other. And Bonnie's friends, what I found was interesting, was they were asking her, "Well, don't Muslim men beat their wives? Don't they make you a secondary citizen?" And she said, "No, it was important to Ijaz that they walked side by side because that's who they were. They were side by side partners." And she said, "What's interesting to me is if she had begun dating someone who was of the Baptist faith or the Jewish faith, no one would ever say, you know, well, he's a Baptist. Do Baptists beat their wives? It's interesting, she said, how that just automatically came out and that people felt justified in asking her that.
Now, you talk about that she didn't have a problem with people's criticism or their lack of open mind, but there was differences despite, well, there was differences, somebody coming from Pakistan, somebody raised in America. And tell us what religion that she had come from, Bonnie, and also what problems, if any, arose in this idyllic marriage, at least it started in the beginning.
Okay, well, they married, and Bonnie had always identified as a Christian. And she told Ijaz from the start, I'm not interested in converting to Muslim because that would make me feel like a liar. I would be lying to you, your friends, your faith, to my faith, if I ever said I was Muslim or interested in changing my religion. Now, she did wear the hijab, which is a headscarf, when she was at the mosque, and she did wear the hijab when some of his friends came over out of respect. And sometimes Ijaz would, you know, become almost exasperated with her because he would say, well, she is showing her legs. And they would say, but Ijaz, that's how it is here. You can wear shorts. You know, you can wear short skirts. And he had an issue at times with those mores. And he would ask Ernestine and Bonnie's sister about it. And if she wore a sleeveless shirt, you know, why does she have to show her arm? But he was also learning at the same time the difference between Western and Eastern culture. Now, Bonnie would tell him, I'm sorry, I'm not interested in becoming a Muslim, and it caused a lot of rift between them. Now, they had a child. His name is Jordan. His Muslim name was Tariq. And they were a very loving, very happy family. Ijaz was raising Tariq as Muslim, and they would go to mosque. And he told me, he said, you know, I would go to mosque on one day and then turn around and go to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints the next day. So he got sort of a well-rounded education there. But, you know, the three of them were very happy, very much in love. They loved their son. If you would see videos of the family together, you could just see it. However, Ijaz did want somebody he could worship with, go to the mosque. She was a partner in every other way, except that she told him, I'm not going to lie to everyone and say, you know, I'm a Muslim. And unfortunately, that caused a rift between them and they divorced.
The thing that happened, though, too, she was taking advice. They were together for 7 years, as you write, and she was taking advice on that she should file on grounds of desertion, would speed up the proceedings, and there wouldn't be a cost of the attorney. So just tell us, despite this, you know, the difficult divorce proceedings, how was Ijaz under these kinds of conditions in terms of anger, in terms of his treatment of her original son, Drake, and their son, Jordan? Tell us how his behavior changed, or what was his behavior during this time, this very stressful time, and tell us what happened in this split and how he felt about it.
Okay. Well, Bonnie did have a son from a prior relationship named Drake. Ijaz immediately took him under his wing, and because Drake's natural father was also Middle Eastern, Ijaz also took Drake to mosque and taught him about the relation and of Islam faith and his history and his background and his culture. And Bonnie began feeling sort of hemmed in with a legal marriage. She began thinking, okay, what if he just turns out to be abusive? What if everything is all fine and dandy now, but in a couple of years it goes south down the road? Now, you have to understand, too, Bonnie came from a abusive background. Her father was abusive. And she just felt like no matter where she turned, something was going to go bad. So the first time they divorced, a friend told her, if you take it on the grounds of desertion, it'll go to the courts, you won't have to worry about custody, and you can just sign your name on the line and get out of there. And she said what was the worst thing out of this whole mess is she had Ijaz served when he had just come back from Pakistan visiting relatives.
Right.
So they divorced, but he would call her, she would call him, both would be in tears, and they eventually reconciled and got back together. And at no time was he abusive, was he hitting her, pushing her, even threatening to. The second time they divorced, again, you know, she filed on grounds of desertion, saying that, you know, she said, I was stupid. I took somebody's stupid advice and I filed. And she ran into an old friend. They did a lot of talking. They started dating, and he proposed. Well, Ijaz heard about this because he's still very close to her family. They have become his United States family. And he showed up at the door, and he was in tears, and he said, you know, how can you marry him? You know we love each other. And she was saying, well, you know, this is just how it goes. This is how my life is going. And at one point they exchanged words, and he said, well, then you do not have custody, you know, full custody of Tariq Jordan. And they exchanged angry words, and they were telling him, Ijaz, you've got to calm down. You need to leave. Take a deep breath, come back, and let's sit down and talk, because it was so uncharacteristic of him to be so upset, which happened. He calmed down, he called, he apologized to the family, and still Bonnie married another man. And it broke his heart. He would be in tears, and he would say, please come back to me. And at one point, when her next marriage was going, Ijaz said to her, promise me you will make yourself happy or leave him. Well, by now, Bonnie has another child by her second husband, and she said, I cannot. He is the father of my child. And Ijaz replied, as I was, as I am. So it's very emotional between them. But again, at no time was she fearful. He would, you know, he raised his voice over this argument, but he never struck at her. He never struck at the family or at Jordan.
And she maintained a friendship even though her husband really was not okay with it whatsoever. She was adamant that she keep this connection, and not just because of the child, but because of the friendship.
Right, right. They loved each other very much. They respected one another. And I think sometimes Ijaz would, you know, wish and cross fingers that maybe one day she'll come back to him. And what really sort of sealed it was when she did marry her next husband, and Ijaz knew then. And even when he would drop Jordan Tariq off at the house, because he would get Jordan on the weekends because of Jordan's school, he would come to his dad on the weekends, and they would invite him into the house, and he said no, because it would be disrespectful to go into Bonnie and her new husband's home, and he being the ex-husband. Now, of course, the new husband, you know, but Bonnie had to sit down and explain to him, there are several kinds of love, and the love I have for Ijaz is different than the love I have for you.
The entrepreneur in Ijaz is that he has lots of rental properties, and after this, he finally realizes that Bonnie's not going to come back to him. He is dejected, but he has some properties, and he buys a house and continues his rental properties, but he has a house on Sea Isle Street, a nice bungalow, brick bungalow, you say, and he's got this business, Regal Imports, selling swords and all kinds of souvenirs and things. So tell us about this home, and still, what is his state at that time? He's visiting with Jordan. What's the relationship he has with Jordan at this time, and what does Jordan, of course, in this book you talk about all the recollections of Jordan about his father. What kind of father is he to Jordan despite being this Muslim, what's he like as a father in America with this 10, 11-year-old boy?
Well, he's a very good father. He had Regal Imports. He would go to Pakistan and purchase items and then bring them over here and sell them in his store. And it was everything from clothing to knickknacks to, of course, swords. And he taught Jordan how to run the business, how to run a business. He taught him how to work a register, how to wait on customers, how to make sure customers had the best customer service. And he taught Jordan about his history. He took him to Pakistan several times, and they met all kinds of families, aunts and uncles and cousins, and then he would take him to historic sites and tell him about the history and the history of the people, the history of the religion. He was just a very well-rounded young man. He worked with him with the languages. And then when Jordan was at his house, you know, he would tell, you know, he would teach him yes, ma'am, and no, sir, and he taught him manners. And he would tell him, you can be anything in America you want to be. You just have to want it and go for it. And that was probably, you know, in my eyes, that's one of the biggest gifts you can give a child is self-esteem. And that's exactly what he gave Jordan. And so they got along well. They lived on a house on Sea Isle. And, you know, Ijal purchased that house in the hopes that Bonnie would come back. He and Bonnie and Jordan could live as a family in this home. And it's not in a horrible part of Memphis. It's more of a middle-class area. 1950-style bungalow home, brick, nice yard, nice backyard. And he maintained several other homes as rental properties. He also sold vehicles. He and his friends would go in together, and they would purchase cars off of lots, and they would get their mechanic to work on the vehicle, and then they would flip it. They would turn around and resell. And if he had friends that needed a car, he would give them one of the vehicles. And if he had friends that needed a place to stay or a job, he would find a place in one of his businesses. For example, he ran a fish market that not only sold fresh fish but also had a little restaurant inside. And he had a good friend that would show up and say, you know, I need money, I need help. And Ijaz would give him a job. He gave him a vehicle and, he gave him a place to stay on the house on Sea Isle as long as he wanted.
Now, you talk about this generous character that he has, very generous, and helping people out. And this leads to an introduction to a woman through a friend. And he tells Ijaz about this woman's predicament. So tell us what this friend says about this woman and who does he meet. Tell us about those circumstances.
Okay. Ijaz, as I said, had a mechanic. Now, again, this mechanic was not much of a mechanic. He's one of those guys that, you know, oh, no, he's working on my car. And people would say, Ijaz, why are you hiring him? Why do you let him work on your vehicle? He does not know what he's doing. And Ijaz would say, he needs help. He needs the money. And he's learning. And so he would have this fellow work on the vehicles. But one day, the mechanic shows up with a pretty blonde-haired girl. Leah was born in 1976. She was raised in and around the small southern Tennessee towns around Memphis. And the mechanic tells Ijaz, look, she's had a hard life. She's living on this. She doesn't have money. She doesn't have food. All she needs is someone to just help her out. And at the same time, Leah is telling Ijaz, well, I want to be a nurse. It's my dream, but it just seems like things keep happening to me, and I can't pursue my dream. And if I just had a chance and a place to live and someone who believed in me. Well, all of this was a lie because at the time, Leah was on parole. She had just been released from prison for doing a stint for selling drugs. She was a known drug addict. She was supposed to be living in a halfway house in Memphis, but I'm guessing Leah probably just decided that that wasn't her style, you know, in a halfway house and following all these rules. Now, she only had 4 months to go on her parole. Leah was a pathological liar. She was also a very violent individual. When she was in school, she was in trouble for fighting. She was writing very sexually charged notes to boys and men. She was keeping a journal of her sexual exploits. She was sneaking out at night, skipping school, drinking, using drugs. And she was in and out of mental health hospitals. She came from a home where the parents were solid blue-collar workers, but for whatever reason, Leah just, she had to break rules, and she would sneak out at night. She would fight with her parents. She had at least 2 stolen vehicles on her record. She stole her brother's truck, crashed it. She stole her grandmother's card and a bunch of checks from her mom's checkbook, crashed that car, wrote hot checks. So here's Leah just kind of bouncing, around. She lands in Memphis. Somehow she knows this mechanic. And I'm thinking what probably happened is he said, hey, listen, I know this guy. And they went to Ijaz's house. Well, Ijaz is listening to her story, and she's a pretty girl. She's a nice girl. She can sell herself well. And Ijaz says, well, I have a house stay in until you get on your feet. It's not in the best of neighborhoods, but you can stay there. And what's interesting is a couple of weeks later, Ijaz contacts her and says, I do not feel safe with you living in that house, in that neighborhood, and you're, a female all alone. So what he does is he lets her stay at his house, but he explains to her, I can't live under the same roof with someone I'm not married to and not my blood. So he moves out to a friend and gives Leah his house to stay in until she, quote unquote, gets on her feet. Meanwhile, he's giving her a car. She starts working it. He's buying her things. And the next thing you know, he's paying her way through school. And unbeknownst to Ijaz at this time, Leah says she's going to school, but she is also stealing his items that he sells in his store, the swords and coin collections and knickknacks. She's smuggling those out of the house to turn around and pawn. And that's when things just started going downhill in that relationship.
She has also not told him her actual status of her, whether she's married or divorced. So tell us a little bit about this Larry Ward, because as far as Ijaz is concerned, she's divorced, but tell us her real status.
Right. One of the lies she tells was she was divorced. She had 2 children that lived with her parents, and they were raising them until she got on her feet. And her children would come and visit later on in the story after they've wed and play with Jordan and such. Well, she tells Ijaz, she's divorced, and he beat her, and he was abusive, and she had to run to save herself. None of that was true. She was still married to Larry, actually. And Larry was raising the 2 children because Leah basically ran out on them. And then, before you know it, she gets charged with a drug charge. She goes to federal prison. And Larry is still raising their children. One of the things that I thought was interesting, too, is Leah was abusive to Larry, and she was very abusive to their 2 children. She would hit Larry, she would lie to him, she would attack him, she pulled a knife on him, she was sneaking out at night, she would disappear for days and they had no idea where she was until she would just show up. She was using drugs, she was drinking. So she was, and I had a conversation with Larry at one point and I said, do you realize at one point you could have been shot? And he said, yes, and that's what scared me. He said, I never stopped thinking about that. So, she's telling him one thing. She's telling everybody else another thing. And yet she's living a completely different life than what she's telling anyone. So she's out using drugs. She's out selling drugs. She's running with a bunch of ne'er-do-wells. and ends up in prison. And meanwhile, her children are growing up, not really knowing her because she's just so sporadic in their life. But she didn't volunteer any jobs, any of this.
Tell us how much she does tell, she's willing to do. I mean, you write about how she's willing to wear the headscarf at certain times and willing to be married in a Muslim ceremony. So tell us how far she goes, and what is it for, just for effect, or how cooperative or willing is she to adopt some of this religion, or enough for him to have her as his wife and to want to have marry in the Muslim mosque. What does she do to secure this, seal this deal?
Well, this is kind of what I think is interesting about Leah, is Leah's going to look out for Leah, but also any time to thumb her nose at her very conservative family, very conservative parents. The prosecuting attorney told me this also. She felt it might be a way to kind of snub her nose at this small town community she came from, you know, her ultra conservative parents, growing up where, you know, religion was so important and you weren't supposed to do this and you weren't supposed to do that. I think it is a way of, or was a way of her kind of saying, oh yeah, watch this. And she did don the hijab. They did marry in a Muslim ceremony. Ijaz came to her and said, perhaps we could learn to love one another. He was a very successful businessman. He was very intelligent. He was very kind. He had his American family here, meaning Bonnie and her parents, but he didn't have a wife and children to kind of make his life complete. And I think that's what he was hoping to find, was that would get married, they would fall in love, and they would have this wonderful, happy life together. So she agreed, and, you know, oh, I've always been interested in different religions and different wives. And so she marries him in a Muslim ceremony. She begins to wear the hijab. She's not wearing as much makeup. She won't smoke in public. You know, she's kind of taken on this role. And meanwhile, she is still married to Larry, who's still back at home, you know, wondering where she is, raising her two children.
What is the relationship with Leah and Jordan, according to Jordan?
Jordan told me that she was always very kind to him. If her children were visiting, and she was taking them somewhere or buying them something, she would always include Jordan when he was there at the house. You know, she didn't make him feel like a stepchild or, you know, not her child. And he says now, when all said and done, he wonders if that was also an act. And they got along fine. But every now and then, Leah would pull these little strange behavioral stunts, so to speak. For example, she dumped them off at the mall, you know, these little kids, and kind of disappeared and then came back to the mall, scooped them up, and had a job on the phone going, well, I don't know where they are. They just took off on me. So she would pull these little reindeer games with the kids. Jordan said he never saw them physically fight. He said, you know, he would hear them fight. He would hear them squabble. But he said to me at that age, you know, parents had squabbles. Parents argued. But he, you know, he told me, he said, I never saw him strike Leah or even attempt to. Now, she did see Leah punch Ijaz in the chest. And some of Ijaz's friends were telling me stories of how Leah had once cold cocked him in the eye, given him a bruise under his eye. She had shoved him, pushed him, punched him in the arm, these kind of things. Because Leah had a hair trigger temper. And even her parents would admit, because she would just flip, you know. And the next thing you know, there's fisticuffs. She was in high school when she pulled the knife on a boy. And she was angry at him because he had pushed her and made her fall down, and everybody laughed, and she was angry because she said he made her look like an idiot. So she came back to school with a knife looking for him. And that's one of the times that she got scooped up by the law and taken to juvenile. She had this hair to her temper that was so unpredictable.
She was doing things like taking money out of his account without permission. Things started slowly but surely. He had friends like Johnny Smith Jr., which was a witness at the wedding, and he didn't see his friends, some of his friends, all the time, but later, as you write in the book, these are people that are questioned and had incidents with Ijaz talking about his married life. So tell us a little bit about what was characteristic about his married life. What was her behavior like? Did she stay at home, or was she out partying? And what did he do about it when he found out?
Well, she was working as a nurse's aide and going to school also. And she would just exhibit this very strange behavior. Like if she was in home health care and she'd be staying with a patient, and she would call Ijaz and just say, "I think this man is going to try to rape me. I'm so scared. I think he's going to try to grab me. I'm so scared to be here by myself." And she would get him all worked up, and he would call the home health care company, and they're saying, "Sir, there is no way we would put one of our employees' life in danger." And he would just get so upset because in his mind, Leah was in a very dangerous situation. Any minute now, she could be sexually assaulted. And those were kind of the things that she would pull, these little human games. Each of his friends saw something different. He was having lunch with one of his very best friends and the friend's business secretary, when she showed up at the restaurant just, raising all kinds of pain because there he sat with another woman. And then every time he was on the phone with business, she would accuse him of cheating. And Ijaz's friends would tell her, "Ijaz is not cheating on you. It is against his religion, and he would not cheat on you." And she would just insist that he's out there seeing every female walking by or a woman walks into the store or onto the car lot and he's after her. But that could be, that's farthest from the truth. He was a very polite gentleman. He could be flirtatious, but he was definitely not interested in being with another woman, in being with anybody besides his wife. And she was, she was pulling all of these little games, and Johnny saw her shove Ijaz and hit Ijaz, and he saw her temper go off. Now, here's something I think that's really very interesting in this whole story. Ijaz had a goat that he kept in the backyard, and the goat died, and Ijaz, he's from Pakistan, and he's a practical man, so he slaughters the goat for food. And Leah just went off on that, and she says to Ijaz, "How would you like it if someone killed you and cut off your head?" And Johnny said, to this day, years later, he can hear her say it. He can see it. He said it just would give him chills, cold, icy chills. So she was so unpredictable.
What was Bonnie's impression? You spoke to her, and it's in this impression is in the book. But initially, what did she have to say, and how much of the concern or her opinion did she share with Ijaz? Again, her friend that she still had great feelings for. So what was her impression, and what did she say? What did she share with him about Leah?
Well, Bonnie was happy that Ijaz had found someone because he had told her he had married. And, he wanted to start a family, and she was divorced and had children. So Bonnie was happy for him, and they still had Jordan together, and both of them, split custody of Jordan. And she was happy he did this. Well, he introduces, and she's hearing these rumors also that Ijaz is seeing this woman named Leah. She goes to meet Leah and she said, instead of just a regular handshake, Leah drug her fingernail across Bonnie's palm when they went to shake hands, and she said, I could feel it. I could feel it. And she said, I knew right away she did not like me, and she goes inside and she tells her husband, something is wrong with that woman. Well, what? Well, I don't know. She said, I can just feel it. And she told her friends and family, she said, she is going to take him for everything he has. Now, Vijay's had a lot of money. You know, he lived very simply. He dressed nicely. He kept himself very well groomed. He had a lot of dollars. And he would carry a lot of cash around also. And she told her family, she said, you know, kind of, well, he's done it this time. And, you know, she had her own things going on in her life, but she was hearing different family members saying, well, Ijah said this and Ijah said that. And her sister, Johnny Joe, remembers the last time she spoke to Ijah, she said, I heard you got married. And Ijah said, oh, no, no, Johnny, she is bad. She is very, very bad. I have to get rid of her. And she thought, okay, I wonder what's going on. You know, it was that sort of reaction. And he and Bonnie would talk, and she, you know, he would tell her he made a huge mistake, and he's got to get out of this marriage. And he's also finding out. He's finding out that his bank account is dwindling. He's finding out that, for example, he had a prized coin collection that was now missing. Money here and there in the house was gone. Items that he had put aside for Jordan, such as jewelry, items from the store Regal Import, all of that was suddenly gone missing. And, of course, Leah was denying it, but yet who else could get into his account? And he was telling friends, you know, again, she has gotten into my account. Again, she has taken money. And he says to his friends, what should I do? What should I do? And his very best friend said, you have to do what's in your heart. I can't tell you what to do. And he would tell his other friends, I have to get out of this because it is bad. And I think in his heart, Ijah thought that he could help her. And then he finds out about the drugs, which he wants nothing to do with that. He finds out about the drinking. And again, Ijah is wanting nothing to do with that, especially around the children. And then he finds out Bonnie is on parole, and she just broke parole. She had to take a urine test, and it turned out dirty. So now she's got to go back to prison. And that sort of set the wheels in a different direction, because that was when he said, I want nothing more to do with this.
And he's hearing other things as well. All his friends are advising him. Anybody that's close to him, like you say, is advising him, warning him, and telling him. Also, he finds out that she does have a history of mental illness and she's bipolar. Again, things that she didn't disclose to him, correct?
Right, right. He was telling friends, he said, you know, he found out that she took medicine, and that was fine, but she was not taking her medicine, and so she was acting very bizarre and very wildly. Now, I really didn't go into the mental health of Leah in the book simply because I'm not a doctor. I don't want to ask someone, you know, third opinion on what's wrong with her. Is she bipolar because she did this? Because when Leah was in and out of the mental health hospital, she was actually diagnosed with several different, you know, disorders. And Leah would not speak to me. And I only had access to so many medical records through the HIPAA laws. So I'm not about to say, well, I think she was, because it's not my place. But she finally admits, yes, I have this, and yes, I'm doing that, and I'm using drugs, and now I've got to go back to prison. Then he finds out, oh, and by the way, I'm also still married to my first husband. So it just all sort of went crashing down.
You talk about, and we mentioned Johnny Smith Jr. on April 12th, he called Ijah. He hadn't spoken to him for a little while, but untypically, Leah answered the phone and quickly hung up. He said he's not here. He left for Pakistan. Now, tell us if he thought this rang true. And just briefly, as for people that may not remember, what was going on a couple of years later after 9/11 in terms of anybody considering traveling to countries like Pakistan?
Right. Now, it did hurt him to know that it was not safe for him to travel home. Those were his blood relatives, and Ijaz was very close to his family there. And because of after 9/11, you know, he knew that no matter how law-abiding you were, if you were Muslim, if you were from that part of the world, you were going to look at, you were going to be questioned, you were going to be watched. And he just felt it was so unsafe that he and a lot of his friends just quit traveling because they felt it was so unsafe for them. So, you know, people would call and say, hey, is Ijaz there? Oh, no, he's gone to Pakistan, quick. Or Jordan would call, or Bonnie, or someone would call him and say, you know, Ijaz did not have a cell phone either. So they're calling the home phone and they're saying, is Ijaz there? Oh, no, he's gone to West Memphis for cars, to buy cars. Okay, when will he be back? He'll probably be back tomorrow. Okay, well, would you have him call me? Well, he's not going to be back for a while. And they kept thinking, okay, this is very strange because, one, Ijaz would always tell them, especially Jordan, if he was going to leave the country. Plus, they knew that because of 9/11, Ijaz was afraid to travel. Now, he did make little day trips to little towns and such around Memphis to purchase cars or to look at vehicles and such. But if he was going to be gone for over a day or very long, he would always tell them. He would always tell Jordan. So they're trying to call Ijaz. They're trying to get a hold of him. Johnny Smith has gone to Florida for a vacation. He comes back, and every time he would call, Leah would say, well, he's gone to West Memphis. He's gone here. He's gone. And finally she says, well, he's gone to Pakistan. And Johnny's thinking, that doesn't even make sense. Because, click, she would just hang up on him. And so she's telling everybody different stories. And I think because at this time, Leah still thinks, even though the news might be tightening, she can get herself out of this because she always has before. And yet the family is going, this doesn't even make sense. He wouldn't do this without telling us, you know, especially him going out of country, out of state, anywhere. And they would call and say, okay, well, have you seen my dad? Have you seen my son-in-law? Have you seen, well, no, he didn't tell me where he was going. So all of this is starting to sort of take place in April. Now, the last that anybody knows of the whole Leah and Ijaz saga is after she went to her hearing since she broke parole, Ijaz was saying, okay, this is enough. This is enough. I want out. He gave her some money, and he put her up in one of the nicer hotels in Memphis. And I'm sure he did that, and his family agrees, because she had kids. He was not about to put her out on the street.
Right.
He had friends tell him, just get rid of her. Throw her out. Put her things out. And he said, but she has children. And he didn't. You know, he loved her kids, too. He didn't want to do that to the little ones. So, you know, beginning April, people are starting to try and get in touch with him. They're starting to call. They even go by the house. Nobody's answering the knock. And, you know, the lawn was maintained because he was very meticulous about how his house and his home looked. But the rest of it, you know, it just seems like everything is kind of spiraling downhill as far as whoever's taking care of the house. There's junk on the carport. The backyard's not maintained. So it just, everybody just started saying, okay, this is weird. Now, Bonnie tried to file a missing persons report, but the law enforcement told her, he's an adult. Maybe he did go to Pakistan. And she's like, but I just have a feeling. Well, maybe he did go buy cars and you're just missing him. She said, no, I just have a feeling. And they told her, well, you know, if they investigated every feeling in Memphis, Tennessee, they would never have time to pursue, quote-unquote, real crime. You know, they can't just say, well, this lady feels like something bad happened. So, you know, it seemed like everywhere they turned, they were getting nowhere.
You also talked about Ejaz told a close friend, I don't know if it was Yared, that once he took her to this hotel, that she had kept a key and was back in her house. So that's how serious it was that he wanted her out, but she was had a key, and so he was saying, I got to get rid of her, I got to stay away from her, I got to get away from her, he had told friends.
Right. He had dropped her off at the hotel. You know, okay, goodbye, here's some money, see ya. And by the time he went back home, she had returned to the house, broke into the house, burglarized it, took everything of value that she could grab. So it's almost like, you know, I can never get out of here. And Ernestine told him, get a restraining order. And he's saying, well, what is a restraining order? So she explains it to him, and he's thinking, okay, I guess I'll have to do that. And she said, Ejaz, take a friend with you so they can explain it to you. And she believed he was at that point thinking, okay, well, then this is what I have to do to get out of here. But, of course, you know, they're not actually seeing one another. She's not going to his house or vice versa. They're doing a lot of talking on the phone because he still trusts Ernestine and he still shares a lot of things with her.
Now, the Jordan and Bonnie, Ernestine are concerned. They can't get a hold of Jordan's father. Leah's telling them various stories. So they go over there one time, and then they go over there again. Tell us when they go over there, the circumstances, and the discovery.
Okay. Well, while Leah is telling everyone all of these Ranger Game stories, she's also packing his stuff up. She's selling it. She's selling all of the cars. She's telling the people who owe Ejaz rent money, well, just give me the money. And, of course, at the time, you know, if you don't know what's going on in Ejaz's house, oh, okay, his wife's going to collect rent from now, no big deal. And she's going to the neighbors. You want to buy some of the furniture? He's moving back to Pakistan. We're getting a divorce. And neighbors are reporting, okay, there's a moving truck there. It was just enough to know. You know, it was just one of those things. Oh, yeah, there was a moving truck in the neighbor's yard. I guess they're moving again. That sort of behavior. And Leah kind of, you know, timed it. She put all of the stuff that she couldn't sell or hawk in a storage shed, public storage. She signed a lease for 4 months when she would be getting out of prison. And then on May the 1st, 2003, she finally has to report in, and she reports to a federal holding facility in Tennessee so she can begin her sentence. Also on May the 1st, finally Ernestine says, okay, that's it. We're going over to the house and we're going to find out what's going on. And Jordan says, well, can I go? And she says, sure, come on. They get in the car. They go to the house on C aisle. The house is closed up. Okay, this is weird. They go to the side, a bunch of junk on the side sidewalk there under the carport. They glance out in the back. Backyard is trash. And they're trying to see through the windows, which are, you know, the blinds are shut very tightly. Well, Jordan manages to see through a part of the window, and he says, all of his stuff is gone. The stuff from his store is gone. So Ernestine goes across the street, and she asks a neighbor. And the neighbor says, oh, well, that lady had a moving van out there a couple of days ago. But, you know, if I think about it, I haven't seen the man that lives there. So they exchange phone numbers. At that point, as they're going back to their car, a little girl in the neighborhood says, hey, they got a chicken in their backyard. Well, that's Jordan's hen. That's his pet chicken. And he says, you know, well, if Dad's not home and Leah's not here, who's going to feed him and take care of him? So he runs to get the cage and get the chicken to bring it to Ernestine's home. And as they're rounding the corner into the backyard, Ernestine says, ooh, what is smelling so bad? And, you know, Jordan is saying, ooh, that smells bad. Well, Ejaz has a metal shed in the backyard where he just kind of keeps various and sundry items. signs and car parts and two old motorcycles, and it's sort of a catch-all area. And it's also where Jordan's chicken had her nest. And Jordan is going, ooh, that smells bad. Now, you have to think it's early May in the South, in Memphis, and I spoke with one of the investigators who said, yes, it would smell bad. However, because of the wind, because of the weather, because of, you know, the soil, the traffic, you're not always going to be able to tell where that foul smell is coming from. So they go to the backyard, and the chicken runs into the shed. Well, to go after his chicken and put him in the cage, Jordan moves some boards out of the way where the doors were originally. The doors wouldn't shut, so he just put some wood up against the empty doorway, open doorway, excuse me. And there's an old foam eggshell mattress on the ground that looks very out of place, and the stench is now unbearable. And Jordan says, well, what's under there? And Ernestine, the mattress, and there is Ijazi's body, where Leah had shot him twice. Later, several days later, she decapitated him. She removed the penis and scrotum, drug his body out to the shed, and stuffed it into the shed, covering it with that mattress. And she had also wrapped a black plastic bag around the body. And they found his 10-year-old son finds his father's headless corpse rotting in the shed. And they go across the street, notify the neighbor again, and that's when law enforcement arrives, seals off the crime scene, and begins the search and investigation.
Now, Leah thinks that she has basically got an alibi. She's not the brightest criminal, and a lot of her behavior seems quite crazed. But she soon becomes the suspect, obviously, and they know where to find her, and they go to question her. And just as she thinks she's in hiding now and has an alibi. So tell us about her reaction to the questioning. You talk about a Sergeant Norris. Tell us about what happens once they get her as a suspect and then they get her for questioning.
Right. Well, as you know, just because you have a suspect or someone admits to the crime, that's not the end of it. There are just days and days and days of investigation. There's people to talk to. There's interviews. There's receipts to be found. Well, Leah thinks, you know, she's going to a federal facility to do the rest of her little 4 months. Marsh will scoop her up and take her to downtown Memphis. And within, you know, a very short time, she confesses. But she also says that Ijaz was very brutal to her, made her wear the hijab, made her be a Muslim, just with a ballistic hair trigger temper, was beating her regularly. She told the story that he went busting into the bedroom, knocking the door off its hinges, choked her. She grabbed the gun. She doesn't remember how. She shot him. She doesn't remember the shooting. And, you know, she starts this self-defense story. And I'm sure in part, you know, she's saying to herself, okay, if I can say self-defense and it was a domestic, you know, relationship, violent relationship, then I'm going to get away with this. And so she starts telling the tale of how Ijaz was just a brutal man and he was mean to her. And, you know, she was just this innocent woman trying to escape. And she had to shoot her way out because she was running for her life. Well, the investigation itself warranted nothing for that because of there was, you know, nothing wrong with the house. There were no doors off hinges. There were no signs of tampering. There were no signs of a door being knocked off a hinge and then replaced. No broken glass, no broken locks, no broken doorknobs. Everything that she was saying happened physically showed that it was a lie. And then, of course, they begin interviewing people about Leah, about Ijaz. And, you know, okay, they've got her arrested for this, but what is the real story? And that's what, you know, again, it slowly starts unpeeling like an onion. Here's what's really going on. And that's with her story of, oh, well, I was an abused woman and I finally had enough and I had to shoot him. Well, you know, there's no marks on her skin. There's no marks, signs of abuse. She's not showing the typical responses or signs of an abused female. And then, of course, they're finding out, well, wait a minute, she was abusive in this situation. She was abusive toward her ex-husband. And her story just basically fell through.
They also, we didn't mention that she had shot him twice, once in the heart, once in the stomach. And maybe we didn't emphasize this, she took his scrotum and penis and cut that off. And in this investigation, you talk about Assistant DA Pamela Fleming and Missy, the district attorney. And she and both of them together have to do an investigation again to prove or disprove her claims completely to be able to do this case, because no case is a slam dunk. And they talk about their discovery of the crack and the meth and then all the things that they discover to not support her case, her tale of abuse at the hands of Ijaz. So tell us what they do find about Leah and her behavior in this marriage.
Well, one of the stories that I found very interesting is they were very hands-on investigators. And, you know, you have your crime scene photos of the shed and that house and where it is in correlation to everything. And so they're literally taking it step by step and saying, okay, if she took the body to the shed, how did she do that alone? So Pamela told me they went to the house and they're looking. The shed is actually closer to the house than you know, you can see in the crime scene photos. And she says, you know, if I'm moving furniture across the carpet, I put something slick in between it and it slides better. It slides well. And she's saying, I bet that's, you know, and they're looking at the crime scene photos at the same time. And she says, I think it's doable. I think she had him on that plastic, was dragging his body, and drug it up into the shed and covered it up with that eggshell mattress. And so that's one of the things that they discovered. And Leah shows up to, I believe it was the hearing, and she has shaved off. Her whole head is just bald. It looks like, you know, she just fell into the head slippers. And as the proceedings begin, Leah curls up into a ball on the floor in a fetal position and stays there during the whole legal process.
Right.
And so Leah was kind of the scuttlebutt of the court system there for a while just because of her very strange behavior. She became pregnant while she was awaiting trial. And again, she claimed it was a rape when she was at the mental health hospital for evaluation. You know, as you know, you have to be evaluated to see if you're legally sane to begin proceedings. Leah
right.
went for her evaluation. She claimed she was raped, but the story just goes all over the place. And they believe that it was someone that was an employee at the jail, and she made up this whole rape as I was in the hospital, and, you know, here I am, the victim, again, of the system. And she just sort of concocted this whole very strange story that did not hold up. To this day, she's still insisting that she was raped while in the mental health hospital. She had the child. She gave it up for adoption. And they said, you know, they don't want a pregnant woman on the stand because of the way a jury would react no matter what she's done. Also, it could be very expensive if they begin the trial and then Leah has to go into labor, have the child, you know, just everything. It could hurt her health. It could hurt the trial. So they had to wait until she had that child. And so there were just, you know, very strange, bizarre things that kept popping up in her behavior and her actions. And then she kept writing the judge, you know, these long, drawn-out letters about all she wants to do is be a mother to her children and to have her child and, you know, have mercy on me because I'm just a, yes, I killed him, but I'm just a battered woman that was standing up for my rights. And she's writing me, she even sent the judge pictures of her kids. So yeah. It was just all these very, you know, and was it mental health? Was it just very bizarre behavior? Was it Linda still trying to play, you know, play her cards to get out of this? Because she always did. She always, you know, was able to talk herself. Leah is streetwise. She's very street smart.
Right.
And, you know, part of me believes that she thinks, okay, if I can just keep talking and keep playing these games, you know, like Ijaz missing, you know, how long did she think the story was going to stand? Oh, he's in Pakistan. Oh, he's in East Memphis. He's in West Memphis. He just left. He just missed him. You know,
yeah.
And did she not think someone would find a dead body in the, you know, backyard in the metal shed in the summer of Memphis? Well, it'll just stay there until, and I'll take care of it when I get out. I could see her thinking that. I'll just take care of it, you know, when I get out of here. And she, quote, never remembered what she did with his head. She says, well, she drove around and she threw it in a dumpster, but she just doesn't remember where. After she shot him, she went for a walk, she said. She just went for a walk around the neighborhood. You know, where did she put body parts? She doesn't remember. You know, well, what did you, oh, but, you know, witnesses came forth and said she had parties in that house. With that dead body. She kept her for a while. She kept it in the bathroom. And it was a 50-style, you know, one of the very small bathrooms. She kept the body in there. And meanwhile, she had parties. You know, there were people going in and out. There was a used condom found when they discovered the body, and they looked through the house. There was, you know, so obviously she, you know, she had some stuff. There was a cake. There was a half-eaten birthday cake in the trash. So people were there. They were celebrating how they did not, you know, she just got away
yeah.
with it, basically. And that's how Leah thinks. And, you know, she would tell people, well, the fridge went out, meaning the refrigerator, so it really stunk the house up. But the refrigerator was working. So, you know, who knows? Who knows what she was feeling?
Well, and this is a, Tennessee's a death penalty state, so, but as you write, there was no woman had been executed since 1900 in Tennessee.
Correct. There's only
now
one woman on death row in Tennessee.
Wow. Now, she has a public defender. She doesn't have the funds. She has a person named Kathy Kent, and you have Pamela. Pamela in this case, and along with the Missy Branham and Paula Fleming, and they're prosecuting this case. And, of course, as you write, the defense is using the defense of self-defense. So how does this proceed, and what is her behavior as the trial proceeds? Tell us a little bit about the trial.
Well, during the trial, she was very quiet, very subdued. She did not take the stand. Pamela said she was surprisingly calm. You know, didn't say, you know, hardly any words publicly. Just very demure. And her husband, Larry, he hears through the grapevine, oh, Leah's, you know, on trial for murder. What? So he shows up. He watches the trial itself only took a few days. You know, Ijaz's loved ones are there watching the trial. Leah, and she was just very calm and collected. And, you know, was she playing the sane but abused person? You know, was she playing the victim? Who knows? Only Leah really knows. Tennessee prisons retain the ability to reduce sentencing based on good behavior when someone is incarcerated. And they don't have parole, you're just out. And she, you know, she didn't receive the death penalty. She received life. However, in order to be released on good behavior, she has to have a spotless record inside prison, which she does not have. You know, Leah can't follow the rules outside of prison. She certainly can't follow them inside. She's been caught with a deadly weapon. She's been caught numerous times for failure to obey orders, or, you know, she was out of bounds in one area. So, you know, even something as simple as, you know, stay out of this area, she's going to cross the line. But the, I'm getting ahead of myself here, but the trial itself, she was just very calm, collected, and when they found her guilty, she turned and looked at Jordan, and her eyes filled with tears, and she, and then that's when they, you know, she stood, and they handcuffed her, and she left the room. And that's the last that anybody who loved Ujai, Jordan, his family, heard of her. And now she's incarcerated. And we're assuming her record behind bars is clear, or going to be. Leah could be released in 2050, and she'll be in her early 80s. But she's there for life. She's not going to be released. Of course, she's writing up all. She's become a legal eagle, and she's writing up a lot of arguments and such to be released. But it's not going to happen.
Right. And the sentence was life without the possibility of parole.
Right. She got a life sentence, and there she sits in the Tennessee prison for women. And see, inmates who get life sentences for first-degree murder, they have to serve a minimum of 51 years in Tennessee.
Right.
And they're only going to be eligible for a 15% reduction during that time period. They're only going to be eligible if they have that good behavior and do what they're supposed to, you know, prove that they can follow the rules and act right. That's basically what it comes down to. Leah's just, it ain't happening.
What about Bonnie and her son, Jordan? What, I know there's no such thing as closure. What did the, did at least the trial rehabilitate, not that his father really seriously had his reputation tarnished by this woman, but what was the, where were they at the end of that trial, Bonnie and Jordan?
Of course, a trial always brings somewhat of a closure, you know. At least Leah was put away so she couldn't hurt anyone else like she hurt that family. And their biggest concern, I see, is why. They want to know why she did it. Why didn't she just walk? He gave her a handful of money. You know, he gave her a place to stay as far as the hotel. You know, why didn't she just walk? Why did she have to kill him? Why did she have to do it so brutally? You know, here's this good man who did the best he could for her, believing that he could help her and he could help make her a good person. And what does she do? She turns around, she shoots him, she kills him, she leaves the dead body in the house for days. She moves it, you know, she beheads him. She moves the body out and stuffs it into a shed, you know, like it was nothing. And then just goes on her merry way to do her 4 months and get out, and then what? You know, why? Why would someone do that? And now you and I know as professionals that there's never an answer to the why.
Right.
You know, there's never really an answer. And, of course, when you're flung into this, you know, you had no idea that several years from now you would have a loved one murdered, and there you are watching the trial. You know, you want to know, why did you do this? You know, he never hurt you. And, of course, you know, when someone is the victim of a crime, victim survivor of a crime, your life is divided into two places, before the crime and after the crime. And it's changed a lot of the way, of course, they've looked at life in general. Some of the family members report that they don't like to go out in public. They don't feel safe in public. You know, they'd rather stay at home. And, of course, you know, there's a high rate of alcoholism and drug abuse in persons who have lost a loved one to a crime. So it's sort of all around the board. Now, Jordan is going to college for his degree. He's very much like Ujai. He's very kind. He's intelligent. He's a very soft-spoken man. Just, he's got such a good heart. And to come out of this, you know, to be who he is saying a lot about both the way Ijaz raised him and his grandmother and his family raised him. And, you know, he said, if I hate her, I'm only hurting myself.
And how is Bonnie today?
I think she's learning a lot about herself, particularly once the book has come out. She's learning that there are parts in her soul and in her heart and in her mind that she wasn't aware of until this time period. Of course, there's a lot of anger toward Leah. There's a lot of sadness toward her. And then there's even a little bit of compassion. You know, what happened to her growing up? What happened to her mental health? You know, what happened to her physical that would make her do this? And I asked them, if you could say something to her, if you could talk to her, would you? And every member of the family said yes. Now, a few were kind of like, you know, maybe, let me think about it, I don't know. But unfortunately, I don't think they're ever going to get an answer from Leah as to why did I do this. I think she'll play the game. Oh, he was hitting me. You know, he made me commit to being a Muslim. Which, by the way, I think part of the reason she beheaded him is because in the Muslim religion, the body has to be buried whole. And I'm wondering if that's not one of the reasons why she did what she did. It's also the kind
right.
of, you know, some her know that him and the religion.
Yeah, and it seems like this story is, in terms of reason, again, there is no real logic or logical reason, but it seems a mix of when you put crack and meth and mental illness, even a little, and a little bit of crack and a little bit of meth and a little bit of mental illness, and you mix it all up, and untoward sort of intentions to marry this guy like a sucker. She did comply, it seemed, but just to be able to seal the deal. So it seems a mix, but certainly She Is Evil is an appropriate title. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about She Is Evil, Madness and Murder in Memphis. For those that might want to look at your other work or find out more about this, do you have a website? Do you Facebook? Tell us how people might get in touch with you and find out more about your work.
I've learned to go all over the social media thing, and you know, whereas before I was like, okay, this computer, if I touch it, it's going to blow up. I'm all over the social media, but you can go to truecrimebook.net or judithayates.com for more of my work, more about me. And I'm also editor of an e-zine called True Crime Case Files Magazine, and you can also find us there. And I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Tweet and Pop and all of those other social media icons.
Great. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming on, taking the time to talking about She Is Evil. Thank you very much for this interview. You have a great evening.
You do too. Be safe out there, Dan. Thank you.
Thank you, Judith. Good night.